Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the South Australian Press Club. I would now like to introduce Mr. Don Riddell, who is President of the Press Club, and he will introduce you to the proceedings for today.
Thank you, Judith. Welcome. Nice to see you all here today. At these Press Club lunches, we have two sort of groups of people. Those who come often, whoever we have as a speaker, and those who come for, especially for that particular speaker. And I can see representatives of both groups here today. And you're a bit blokey, I think. You're a bit blokey. So I think maybe the football side of it has won over today. So just to tell you what's going on, you'll be served now a magnificent lunch. And we hope you've got it mainly finished by about 1 o'clock, because then I'll introduce our speaker. If you haven't finished at 1 o'clock, just eat quietly. Don't scratch your knife across the plate. Just keep on eating. And I'll be back at 1 o'clock to introduce our speaker. In the meantime, Judith's got some housekeeping for us. Thank you.
Thank you, Don. First of all, I'd like to just acknowledge the people who make today possible, the Press Club Committee, who are volunteers. Thank you, committee members. I'd like to thank Telstra, who are so good at supporting the Press Club whenever it needs any form of assistance. Thank you, Telstra, and it's nice to see you at the table here today. SA Brewing. Where's the lovely Robbie Cooter, who's our favourite person? Thank you, Robbie. SA Brewing has supported the Press Club for as long as I can remember. You have some excellent beer from them today. We have Suffolk Stout, Pilsner 107, and I hope you'll go on enjoying that beer throughout the lunch. We have Orlando Wines, the backbone of the Press Club's nice drinking. We have, I believe, some special guests from Orlando here today, and I do hope that you'll enjoy drinking the 2001 Jacobs Creek Reserve Riesling and the 1999 Jacobs Creek Reserve Shiraz. We have a raffle. There'll be raffle tickets on your table, and the Press Club, being largely a volunteer organisation and a non-profit one, relies upon your support through the raffle. So I would ask you to try and find that envelope and pass it round the table, please. We've got some wonderful prizes. From Telstra, a Uniden cordless telephone. We have some special guests here today, the Adelaide Symphony Orchestra, who kindly donated not one, but two special morning teas for six people listening to a rehearsal of the orchestra. Now, I think that's a pretty unusual raffle prize, so I hope that you'll participate on the basis of doing something slightly cultural. We have some beer from SA Brewing, some Hahn and some Pilsner. And we have rather a special prize that Rex Jory's brought down from the advertiser. And this is to balance the gender balance that Don was talking about before. There's an Aboriginal painting over here that's come from somewhere near Uluru. And it's called Women's Business. So there you are, there's a way to respond. Rex did it himself, yes, dot, dot, dot. So we have some excellent prizes there, and I hope you'll pass the raffle tickets around. That'll be drawn at the end of question time. Thank you very much indeed. I hope you'll enjoy the lunch. And as Don said, we'll be back to talk to you at 1 o'clock. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. Wayne Jackson, our guest today, is of course Chief Executive of the Australian Football League, a position he's held since 1996. It's a pleasure to see him here at the South Australian Press Club because he's one of us. And we all hope he makes that clear to the Melbourne Cricket Club, but more of that later, I'm sure. Wayne says he'll answer questions from anyone else. If the media runs out of questions, he's only too prepared to answer questions from others later on. What can be better for an Australian bloke than to spend your life mucking around with footy and booze? But I'm sure today we'll find out there's much more than that. Here's some of it. Wayne was born in Adelaide in 1944, educated at Prince Alfred College and completed a Bachelor of Economics degree at the University of Adelaide. He worked at Deloitte, Touche Tohmatsu, and in primary industry, and in 1968 he joined the family-owned Thomas Hardy and Sons. He was general manager in 1977 and managing director in 1981. In the next decade, he presided over a spectacular growth in this traditional old winemaking company. They bought Chateau Ranella and restored it splendidly. They took over a lot of companies, including Leasingham from H.G. Hines. I think it was Wayne Jackson who famously remarked that Hardy's had reduced Hines to 56 varieties. Then came the State Bank disaster and Hardy's merged with Barry Romano and floated. This was probably a disappointment for Wayne, but he bounced back as chief executive of the South Rain Brewing Company in 1993. But he had more than beer in mind in his mind. Beer and wine in his mind? He'd been a pretty good footballer. Amateur league, and then some 160 games for West Tyrone's. Down there on Thebe Oval, where the goalposts always seem to be in the wrong position. And Wayne had this awkward sort of Matthew Primus type of kick, and he flapped his arm like a duck when he kicked. He served the SANFL and has been a board member of both Austrade and the Australian Wine and Brandy Corporation. In his spare time, whenever that is, he enjoys golf and farming. Indeed, we're fortunate to have him here today, as a year or so ago he had a bad fall from his tractor and broke, I think, some 8 ribs. Sick to footy, Wayne, it's safer. Now, of course, he runs the world from Colonial Stadium. Please welcome the distinguished son of South Australia, Wayne Jackson.
Thank you, Don, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I suspect that intro was written by a former Hardy's colleague of mine, Bob Main. I often say in Melbourne, yes, I did play 170 games for the Mighty Eagles, the real Eagles, and the unfortunate part of those, about half of them were in the twos. But it doesn't get reported all that often, so I'm not fussed by it. I'm absolutely chuffed to be able to speak today, not the least of the reasons being there are a number of people in the room I recognise, some from old days with Hardy's Wines, some from South Australian brewing days with Robbie Cooter, who I think I employed and love to see her working for the AFL, Peter Ward and other people like that, and a number of footy friends in the room, including the president of the Port Adelaide Football Club, Greg Bolton, and board director Frank Hayter. And if nothing else, I think they'll serve to keep me honest as I chat to you for the next few minutes. This morning, I spent the morning down at Port Adelaide with a colleague, Andrew Dimitriou, and speaking this afternoon with the Adelaide Crows. I've now spoken at two national press club luncheons in Canberra, and I do therefore understand, Don, that people do wish to ask questions, and I'll try very hard to answer any questions you do have a little later. I only plan to speak for about 15 minutes, so what happens thereafter is up to our chairman, Don, and your questions. Not so long ago, thank you, Richard, not so long ago, AFL footy, in the memory of most people in this room, VFL footy, AFL footy, was in deep trouble. And for those of us that look at that slide and start thinking about Fitzroy, just recall that the Mighty Eagles merged with Woodville to become Woodville West Torrens. Not long after that, South Adelaide moved out of their traditional home grounds to go down to Noarlunga. There's lots of talk about whether Central Districts, who came into the competition in the early 60s, should merge with North Adelaide. So footy around the whole country was in trouble. It just wasn't Victoria. I'd like to spend a few minutes explaining why I think, after about 6 years in this job, the real three or four reasons why Australian footy has really kicked on, and I think you'll be able to relate to it. First of all, what's not commonly understood is that the AFL is directed by an independent board of directors. And those directors are democratically elected. So the 16 AFL clubs actually elect the AFL Commission. And if they were so minded, they could turn that whole commission over in 3 years, because two or three of the commissioners have to retire each year. Bob Hammond, one of us, is a commissioner and has been for the last couple of years. But the prior year to that, Terry O'Connor, chairman of the Anti-Corruption Commission in Terry O'Connor, who's chairman of the Anti-Corruption Commission in Western Australia, and a very, very strong football person, was voted out by the 16 clubs, which they're perfectly entitled to do, in part because of his attitudes to the promotion of Australian football on a national basis. The commission is broadly based in terms of skills. At the one end, we have a Chris Langford, an absolute footballing icon, actually now living in New South Wales. Ron Evans, who's played a lot of Victorian football and represented Western Australia. Graham John, CEO of Australia Post, but a former coach of South Melbourne and a strong footballer. And, of course, Bob Hammond, whose football heritage can't be questioned. So that's at one end of the scale. And at the other end of the scale, we have people like Graham Samuel, who is chairman of the Anti-Corruption Commission, the Competition Council in Australia. Colin Carter, who's just retired as a senior vice president of the Boston Consulting Group, and with great respect to those guys, I don't think they'd have any idea of what's on the inside of a football, but they make a magnificent contribution to the commission. And the other two commissioners are myself and Bill Kelty, and most of you would know Bill or know of Bill through his trade union activities. So the commission, I stress, number one, democratically elected by the 16 clubs. They can get rid of the commission in a flash. Two, it is independent. And once the guys sit around that table, I can absolutely promise you that Bob Hammond doesn't come around that table with the South Australian hat on, nor does anybody else. I guess it's not all that balanced. We haven't got strong female representation here today, but there are no females on that commission. They are coming through the football system. We have a number of football clubs now with females on boards of directors. We've got a number of football clubs with females coming through into senior executive roles. At the AFL, one of the senior executives is a girl called Jill Lindsay, who runs all of our ground manager issues. So females are coming through, and I'm reminded of a fact about 3 years ago when we had had a meeting with all of our 16 presidents and CEOs, which we do about three or four times a year. And on this particular meeting, we were talking as a group, and formally so, about the need to get balance onto the commission and what about females? And John Elliott said, that's a ludicrous idea. He said, nobody can come onto this commission until they've played at least 200 games. To which Michael Smith, at his first meeting as the president of the West Coast Eagles, reacted very angrily and said, that's absolutely atrocious, John. You can't make comments like that. That's just so unfair and discriminatory. And John said, you're absolutely right. I do apologise. 150 games. The second reason why the AFL does work is that we have broad-based equalisation strategies. On the ground, performance is manipulated via the salary cap and the draft to give all teams, we think, a reasonable chance of winning each time they sit on the go across the white line, play on the field. And if you only stop and think about where we are now, for example, most of us would say on every occasion where there's a footy match in season 2002, both teams have a reasonable chance of winning. That's not the situation you find yourself in most other sports in the world. And it's there because, and we South Australians, I think, recognise it more than anybody else. In the 80s, the Stephen Kernahans and the Craig Bradleys and the Peter Motleys and the Mark Naylies, all those sorts of players ended up at the Carlton Football Club because at that time, Carlton have the greatest capacity to pay, and they could pay the most. And whilst a guy like Stephen Kernahan, who was a wonderful servant of the Glenelg Footy Club, and as many of you would recall, only went to Carlton after Glenelg won a premiership. I mean, those players carried a club like Carlton for much of the 80s. But we did introduce a draft, and we did introduce a salary cap. And whilst, as Don said, not all of you are football people, that simply means that if any lad wants to play in the AFL, he must submit himself to the draft, and the team that finishes bottom has first pick of all the players in the draft. Please be assured that all of the clubs and the AFL know today 95% of the top 100 boys playing football in Australia between 16 and a half years of age and 20 years of age today. Port Adelaide and the Crows will know exactly and have got fingered the players that are of interest to them in this year's draft. Whether they can get them or not remains to be seen, because with a little bit of luck as quarter travelling, they may well have the last pick in the draft this year. That simply means that they will pick up, if the system is true, about the 17th best player in Australia, aged 18 onwards. So as a result of that, Fremantle have picked up some wonderful players in the last couple of years, and you're starting to see that in their on-field performance. St Kilda have picked up a couple of absolute gems in Nick Riewoldt, and the people that follow the Crows will see this tall, 6'6" blonde fellow on tomorrow night, the football park, and you'll see one of the best footballers you'd ever wish to see at 19 or 20 years of age. And they've got two or three of those guys coming along. So the system is designed, sadly, in some respects, to reward mediocrity, because the worst performed teams get the best players. The second in the draft, the second issue there, of course, is equalisation is brought about by the salary cap. And we have a very strong rule, strongly supported by all of the clubs, that the players should only be able to have a certain level of income that each club will pay. It's about $6 million at the present time. And some of you would say, well, that's only fair. Others would say, well, that's ridiculous. You can take either viewpoint. The average player playing in the AFL today, about 570 will play a game during the course of the year. The average player earns $150,000 a year. So if you're a 21-year-old lad, on average, after balancing across the whole of the football spectrum, the average wage a player earns is $150,000. The best players earn $500,000, maybe $600,000. Our annual report says that seven players earned over $500,000 last year. And we think if the players are prepared to have their salaries capped, it is reasonable for them to have a reasonable level of average income. Example, arguably, Warren Treadray is, with Andrew McLeod, well, it's arguably, certainly Warren Treadray with Andrew McLeod, the best two footballers in South Australia. Their salaries are capped by Port Adelaide and by the Crows. And in an open market, I would suggest to you that Treadray and McLeod could earn twice what Port and Crows are paying those two fellows. Now, they accept the cap, and in return for that, we get equalisation and the draft. And the end result of all of that is that on-field, it's basically equalised. The evidence is that up till 1991, excluding Fremantle and Port Adelaide, who are the two most recent additions in the competition, 12 teams played in the preceding 10 years grand finals. 12 teams played in the preceding year's grand finals. So it's not Manchester and Liverpool and Arsenal who every year play in the grand final. In the AFL, it does swap around, and it swaps around because we've got these artificial constraints which equalise the competition. If all goes as Frank and Greg would wish, and as most South Australians would wish, I hope, we'll add another team that plays in a grand final this year that have never played before in Port Adelaide. So just maybe, after a 10 or 11 or 12 year period, Michael Angiarucci's here in front of me and he knows the numbers better than I do, just maybe over that 10 or 11, 12 year period, every team would have played in a grand final with the exception possibly of Fremantle. The third element behind the independent democratically elected commission, equalisation on field by draft and the salary cap, is there is, and this may be even more contentious, some equalisation, significant equalisation of income streams in the competition. The AFL has a total income, and I'm rounding off to tens of millions of dollars, so please excuse me, but the AFL has revenue in the order of $140, $150 million. And putting aside contra-advertising and all of that sort of stuff, $100 million comes from our broadcasting rights and $20-odd million comes from our sponsorship. Those two main income streams are equalised amongst all 16 teams in the competition. Problem. We Essendon are arguably, we Collingwood, if you read yesterday's paper, I think you'd be half convinced, we Collingwood are the AFL's most important assets. We bring on Anzac Day, Collingwood versus Essendon, 80-odd thousand people. When the Collingwood army is flowing, it makes a huge difference. Why should we Collingwood, who brings so much to this AFL competition, only get the same amount out of it as Fremantle or the Western Bulldogs or the Kangaroos, the latter two being in the same town, with one quarter or one fifth or one tenth of the influence of those two clubs? The answer to that is that we believe, it goes back to the salary cap issue, we believe that all clubs have got to have a reasonable chance of survival in this competition. And most of the people in this room are business people, entrepreneurial in spirit, and that would be contrary to what you and I would wish in our businesses. But the reality is, in business, you don't need competitors. You may have them, but you don't have to have them. In footy, we do need 8 or 10 or 12 or 14 or 15 other teams to play against. Otherwise, the whole system collapses. So it would be, in the eyes of some, terrific to reward Collingwood and Carlton and Richmond and Essendon and the two clubs in Adelaide who both pull their weight plus some, and one or two clubs from other states and divvy the income up that way, but it just means that a half a dozen other teams in the competition would fall out of the floor, so or fall through the floor. So off-field, we equalise major income streams. We don't equalise them all. For example, we don't equalise gate receipts. And clubs in Melbourne would say, well, the Adelaide Crows in particular and the West Coast Eagles, increasingly Port, sell reserved seats at Football Park or Subiaco Ground, so Subiaco Oval. We don't have the opportunity to do that if we are Hawthorn at the MCG because the ground's too big. We don't have the opportunity to do that if we're Fremantle because not enough people want to come to our games. We think, Port and Crows, that your reserve seat income should go into the gate so that we all get some share of that through an equalisation fund or whatever. So we've got competing pressures on us. On the one hand, we're trying to equalise income. On the other, you can't penalise success. And in Adelaide, in particular, you've got two clubs pushing very, very hard. And they'll only push to a point if they're then going to be penalised. It's like touching the electric fence. If you touch it and it hurts, you pull away. How much initiative can we give clubs to encourage them to be innovative and to be going for it? On the other hand, if you go too far, we're going to be pulling it back. Look, the best example I can give you of that is in South Australia, and it's not commonly known, but it's often reported, both Port and the Crows give up about 80% of their net profit each year to the South Australian National Football League. They do the same in Western Australia, where the Dockers and the Eagles are owned by the West Australian Football Commission. It doesn't happen anywhere else in Australia. 80% of Essendon's million-dollar profit doesn't go into Victorian football. 80% of Collingwood's $1.3 million, as I read yesterday, doesn't go into Victorian footy. If Port Adelaide make $100,000 and the Crows make $500,000, 80% of that goes back to the South Australian National Football League and into grassroots footy throughout the state. So there are other factors at work in this state and in Western Australia which aren't at work in other states of Australia. I don't want to give the impression that total revenue is the be-all and end-all. The reality is that in 1990, when our clubs had $1 or $2 million a year revenue, we had three or four clubs really struggling. In 1995, when the annual revenue, the average annual revenue of a club was about $5 million, we had two or three clubs struggling. This year, 2002, our clubs will have average income in the order of $15 million. Top end, West Coast Eagles, $24 million. Essendon, $22 million. Bottom end, Bulldogs, Kangaroos, $12 million. So let's, on average, say about $15 or $16 million. It's not how much income the clubs earn, it's the gap between the rich and the poor. And if we're going to continue to have a very even competition, we do have to have some equalisation of income, and that's a very sore point, very debatable point from clubs who are either doing well or who are naturally entrepreneurial and don't want to be penalised. There's just four numbers I'd like you to try and remember, and these are average numbers over the last couple of years. Over the last three years, the AFL's average income, and I've told you I'm being very broad in averaging out, is about $115 million. Cost us about $50 million to do all the things that are done at the AFL level, and no one has accused the AFL of being fat and inefficient. So let's assume we are reasonably efficient. So we have a $65 million surplus. $65 million surplus over $115 million worth of revenue. I think most of you would agree it's not a bad return. But of that $65 million, $50 million is distributed to the clubs as dividends. 16 clubs getting total $50 million. So $65 million surplus, $50 million immediately goes to the club, and the remaining $50 million goes to the club, and the remaining $15 million is reinvested in what's called game development. Net result of the AFL, zero. So on an average year, the AFL doesn't make any money at all. It goes to the clubs or it gets reinvested in the game. So we are a socialist cooperative. We are a money exchange that money comes in, money gets paid out. There is no big fat AFL oozing in cash anywhere. In fact, Bill Keelty, to whom I referred earlier, Bill Keelty says that the AFL is the most socialistic organisation with whom he's ever worked, and I think that says something about what we do. The end result of, Richard, the end result of a democratically independent board, equalisation on the field through the draft and the salary cap, and equalisation of income comes out with what I think are some pretty impressive results. Comparing that with where we were in the mid-80s, I think it's just an achievement that all of the clubs and the people that are involved in clubs and AFL should feel pretty proud. This year, line two, in fact, our clubs will end up with more members than we had last year, which is a staggering effort. But I just wanted to comment and dropping over economic impact that may appeal to some of the people in the room. It certainly does to us. But one of the major differences I find in this job relates to the next line, 600 accredited journalists. You may not all know that in the AFL, accredited photographers and journalists are about 600 people covering the footy on weekends, and a lot of them writing about every day of the week. There are 150 journalist covering federal parliament. And I think that tells you something about our approach to the AFL. And in truth, from time to time, I'm asked, what's the big difference in this job and being the MD of the Southland Brewing Company or working at Hardy's? The big difference is you've got guys like Michelangelo watching every single thing you do and looking for information and trying to interpret things. Terrific for the game, but we all pay a pretty, I guess it's got to be acceptable price for those 600 people being involved. I do want to touch on the second last one, and maybe it will come up in question time, but more people are watching television, football on television today than ever before, and about 5%, and this is after the English soccer, sorry, not the English soccer, the World Cup soccer, after World Cup soccer, our television audiences in total, with 9 and 10 and Foxtel, are up about 5% on last year. So, pretty impressive results. I think the second last thing I'd like to show you is we're not complacent, and we've got a heap of things ahead of us that do have to be tackled, and some of them will take some years to get on top of. There is so much to interest young men and young women today. Our real threats are all of the entertainment options. It's videos, it's PCs, it's the internet in particular. It's the beach. Increasingly, it's films. So whether you're rugby union or league or soccer or tennis or cricket or Australian football, our single most important threat is what people, young people in particular, do with their leisure opportunities. It's really hard to get kids who are 12 and play their sport at primary school to stick at it in secondary school. It's even more difficult once they leave the school environment to get them to go and play in a club environment, and all sports are finding that. Australian football has a peculiar one because our absolute heartland is in the south with Victoria and South Australia and West Australia and Tasmania. But the reality is that 55% of all Australians in 10 years' time are going to live in New South Wales and Queensland. And Queensland will be bigger than the state of Victoria, obviously. So at the present time we have reasonably strong AFL teams there in the Swans and the Lions, but footy at grassroots level is nothing like we experience here in South Australia, and somehow we have to continue to invest strongly up there to adjust to these population shifts. I won't go through through all of those other than to comment on the second last one. I truly believe that in the last 6 months, maybe a year, Australian football has come a long way to beginning to address its costs, that we collectively, AFL and clubs, understand that you can't actually spend more than you earn and stay in business over the long period of time. We are starting to get player payments back to a more respectable level, from 15% increases, 12%, current year 7%, next year 6.5%, but going forward the players do have to understand, I'm sure they will, that increases of that magnitude can't be sustained. And whilst we in South Australia were certainly not immune from World Cup soccer, believe us, World Cup rugby next year is going to be just huge, and we'll be going through it all again. So there are some real pressures there. The final thing I want to touch on before answering questions is that I think the clubs and the AFL understand better today our absolute need to connect to the communities and the fans than we ever have before. If you read the papers, you may not believe that. But an extraordinary effort from clubs, and none more so than the two clubs in South Australia, goes into promoting football, certainly their club in part, but AFL footy in the community. We've moved at AFL level from about 5 years of the television campaign, I'd like to see that, to the last year or two when we had I Was There and we had you know, Barry Robin dodging around Jezelenko on the Adelaide Oval and winning the premiership of the Australia club league team at some past time for North Adelaide. And we are doing now television ads which we think relate to the community. So the last thing I'd like to do is to show you these ads which are now going right around Australia. There's a couple of seconds of introduction, then there are four ads. They take in total about 2 minutes. So if you would please concentrate those and concentrate on those, and then I'll happily respond to any questions you've got. Thank you. Then there's the four ads. After those four ads, there's another series coming which relate those kids and country people in coming into the AFL and doing their thing. Don, I'm very happy to respond to any questions. I've consciously left out a couple of sensitive ones. I'm sure they'll come up in questions.
Thanks very much, Wayne. Now, questions. First from the media, and if the media runs out, it's open slather. But would you go over to the microphone over on that side to ask her questions? Perhaps you could queue up behind the people. And when you give your name and your organisation represent, so Wayne knows who he's dealing with.
Rex Jury, the advertiser. G'day, Wayne. As probably the only person in the room who's actually played football in the same team as yourself, I've got two questions. Has there been any consideration given to using the Adelaide Oval as a temporary home ground, perhaps, for some of the struggling Victorian clubs to use here on perhaps a Friday night game against Port or the Crows, rather than playing that game in Victoria? And in fact, has there been any broader thought of utilising the Adelaide Oval in the AFL program? And a totally unrelated question, are we ever going to see Wayne Carey play football again?
The answer is no and yes. The LA Oval's a really interesting one because, like I'm sure everybody in this room, just a fantastic venue. Maybe a little commercial and a little direct, but fact of life is Adelaide can't afford to first-class stadium. Melbourne can't afford it. Sydney can't afford it. Stadium Australia and the SCG. Western Australia, much bigger than we are, Perth, can't afford Subiaco and the Wacker. So, question, why do we want to invest a lot more money in Adelaide Oval when we have a fantastic stadium at Football Park? If you spoke to the ACB, and I will not speak on their behalf, I think you'll find the ACB would rather play a test match in front of 54,000 people at Football Park than 30 or 35,000 at Adelaide Oval. Next point is I don't see why we, as taxpayers, ought to be funding stadium development. Today, Football Park has changed its name to Amy Stadium, and through the work of the South Australian National Football League, many more millions of dollars will be available to upgrade Football Park, provide facilities for football fans, do things for the community at no cost to the taxpayer. Now, having said all of that, absolutely love Adelaide Oval, great place for local footy, South Australian National Football League, great place for cricket. But Adelaide simply will not be able to carry, like Melbourne, Sydney or Perth, two first-class facilities. I know that's not a popular view, but Rex, it's a direct answer to a very direct question. Second question, I very much hope that Wayne Carey does come back. All the signs are that he will, and he'll come back fitter and stronger with no niggling injuries than he's ever done before. And I'll be amazed if he can't play another 2 or 3 or 4 years in a club that looks after him. And I think he will be able to elevate the standards of some clubs because he is a wonderful leader. I've been to Ireland with him and seen how he manages the All-Australian team. The answer is I think he will. I'm sure he'll come back, and I hope he does. And I see absolutely no reason at all why he shouldn't.
Hi, Wayne. Doug Robertson from the Advertiser. I have two questions, if I may. Firstly, we have at least 5 SNFL clubs here in Adelaide going broke because of the AFL, and they think they hope to survive on pokey parlours. What responsibility does the AFL have to those clubs? And secondly, you say that more people are watching the AFL now, but are more kids playing the AFL? Or are more numbers playing soccer?
Thank you, Dave. I don't understand why the AFL has any responsibility to SAFL clubs. I've already said that through the licences of the Crows and Port, when Port have completed paying off their licence fee, which is about $600,000 per annum, millions of dollars will flow to the South Australian National Football League from those 2 licences, and they only flow because those 2 teams are playing in the AFL. Point number 2, the AFL does provide development support for the SAFL. But why should the AFL do that if the SAFL has a very high salary cap, if players are being attracted from Sydney to play in the SAFL for money, if they're being attracted from Tasmania to play in the SAFL because they think they'll get a better chance of being picked in the draft and being paid? The AFL's not interested in players at SAFL level being paid a lot of money to play. We're interested in developing kids and bringing them through the system and them optimising their performance and not doing it for money. So that's answer number 1. Doug, and your second one, I'm sorry because I didn't write that one down, just touched on the words.
The numbers playing football at the moment.
Yeah. AFL, Australian football participation rates are increasing at the rate of about 3% per annum. I suspect soccer's doing better than that, but soccer has an even bigger fallout at that 12 to school level, school level to club level than does AFL. We've all got our problems, so I'm not suggesting we haven't, but participation rates in Australian football are increasing year on year. Very tough job, particularly in developing states. But we don't focus just on soccer, Doug, for reasons I outlined up there. There are heaps of other competitive pressures as well.
Welcome home, Wayne. Michelangelo Ricci from the Advertiser. You have two preliminary finals due this year and a contract with the Melbourne Cricket Club that is causing you some difficulty. Can you reach a commercial arrangement as you have for the qualifying finals and the semi-finals to ensure that, for the fairness and integrity of the competition, the best ranked teams will play their preliminary finals at home, be it Football Park, the Gabba, Subiaco, wherever?
I'm surprised by that question, Mark Ainsley. We sincerely hope so. In the late 80s, the AFL Commission agreed to play its part in the Great Southern Stand being built at the MCG, and part of the arrangements made 13 or 14 years ago were that we would play a game each week of the final series at the MCG. The problem was there was no Crows at that time, no Lions, certainly no Power and no Fremantle. So we had a Victorian competition with the Swans in it and just in it. And the Eagles is very fresh in it as well. Times have changed, and we still have a 42-year commitment to play a game each week of the finals. It has been varied so that we can bank finals for the qualifying final and the preliminary final. We're not there with the preliminary final. I didn't mean to. Qualifying final and semi-final. The preliminary final, it is inequitable, it's not fair on the clubs, it impacts on the integrity of the competition, and I just hope that as we continue to grovel to the MCC and the MCG, that I'll eventually see the unfairness of that, particularly in an environment where we're happy to make up the financial cost to them or the financial benefit to the MCC / MCG in a subsequent year when, for example, two Melbourne clubs both qualified to play the preliminary finals in Melbourne. So the short answer to the question, Michelangelo, big problem, long-term contract, will need understanding, empathy, good grace and a sense of partnership to enable us to get out of it. The big problem is, ladies and gentlemen, that if Port finish first or second and Brisbane finish first or second, they'll only be, subject to them both winning their first round in the finals, they'll only be a preliminary final played in either Adelaide or Brisbane. I was speaking to Mark Williams about this morning. He did have a view.
On another ticklish issue, you've been hedging around for 4 or 5 years on clubs wearing very similar Guernseys, which is not helping the image of the game. Hasn't it reached the time where the Commission just in October declares every club must submit 3 jumpers, a home, an away, and perhaps a pre-season, which can be used when there is even a clash with away jumpers?
Yeah, that's a very fair and constructive criticism. We're very unhappy at the clashes of colours. Some clubs have had it written into their constitution that they can't change their stripes without the support of all members. You know how what the likelihood of that would be, but we believe the licence agreement will override the constitution in any event. I think we're getting more and more clubs, particularly having watched World Cup soccer, understanding how silly it is to see clubs with similar Guernseys playing. We're not actually looking for a home, for a traditional Guernsey, home, an away Guernsey, an alternate Guernsey. We'd like a traditional Guernsey and an alternate Guernsey. We were thrilled with the initiative of Port in what they did this year, and they clashed with Collingwood. But I'm not looking forward, as happened a year or two ago when Essendon beat Melbourne in the grand final. I'm certainly not looking forward to Port Adelaide playing Collingwood in the grand final, because I don't think either club will give a half an inch on its traditional uniform, and it's not something that the people at the ground or the people on television will enjoy seeing. So it has to happen, Michelangelo. I think we're creeping up on people. They can see it's coming, but we are creeping up, and I'm just hopeful next year or so will resolve it. Not just the Guernseys, it's the socks, and that's why we're anti, you know, wearing tennis socks. It's the guys that wear the cycle pants under, and when you wear your Guernsey out, you can't see the colour of your shorts at all. So if you've got white shorts on, but you've got your black Guernsey coming out, well, it doesn't matter what colour shorts you've put on. So it's not just the alternate strip, it's the whole package that you present, socks, shorts, and the Guernsey.
Wayne, Hamish Harper from Channel 9. What are your impressions of the deal that was announced at Football Park this morning to rename it Amy Stadium?
My reaction is one of extreme positiveness. Good Australian company. When you see the details in the advertiser tomorrow, you'll understand they're doing some positive community things as part of this sponsorship. Most importantly, Australian football fans will get better facilities, because the SAFL will obviously receive substantial income over 10 years. The arrangement is 5 years plus 5 years. And I guess that goes to the core of what I was talking about earlier with the Adelaide Oval. I mean, here is private money, hopefully supporting, must be supporting, the company providing it, Amy, and we, the football fans, get the benefit of all that. It is terrific that in the last few years, about $1 billion has gone into grounds where AFL footy's played, Footy Park, Colonial Stadium, Stadium Australia. I'm not claiming it for football, but we're playing our footy there. The Gabba's just been redeveloped magnificently, as has Subiaco. So one of the reasons Australian footy fans, I think, are still supporting footy strongly, particularly women and children, who are 47% of all those that go to our game, are the quality of our stadiums, and the Amy support will further enhance that. So I think it's a terrific initiative on the part of the SAFL.
The AFL's been very vocal on Matthew Pavlich. If the Brisbane Lions were to make an offer to Matthew Pavlich as manager this week, a new contract for next season, what specific rule would the Brisbane Lions be breaking? And what's the difference between Carlton making an offer to Matthew Richardson's manager this week, because he's out of contract at the end of the year as well?
Well, forgetting about the timing, whether it's this week or next month, Matthew Pavlich can only go to a club who is prepared to trade for him, or he will go in the draft. If he goes in the draft, he gets picked up by, well, if he's the best player in the draft, he'll get picked up by the team that finishes bottom. If that team is Carlton or Richmond or St Kilda, and if that team has won 5 games or less, that club will get two picks, before any other club gets it. So number one, he can only go to a club if he gets traded, and for Brisbane to pick him up, I suggest you'd be talking about a Michael Voss or a Jason Ackermanus plus Nigel Lappin or whoever, or you go on the draft. So there's a lot of haggling to be done.
I'm just more talking specifically about the rules, and that is it against AFL draft rules for a club, whether it be Brisbane or another club, to present an offer to Matthew Pavlich as manager at the moment, bearing in mind he hasn't run his contract yet and he's still under contract at Fremantle?
Yeah, it is against the rules, but all of the clubs know who is coming out of contract, and they behave themselves largely responsibly, and I'm absolutely sure Port and the Crows would have spoken to Matthew or his manager or his family, but they do it discreetly and they don't talk about it from the rooftops, because in another month or two there is a formal trading period when all that will be done. So it lacks pace to be doing it in a very public sense, but it is generally accepted that late in the season, players coming out of contract will be contacted by clubs to see exactly what their position is. But it is against the rules.
Christopher Gelly, freelance. Cheryl Curnow and Wayne Carey, do you have a view on publicity of personal events in the lives of high profile people in football, politics, or anything else?
I think.
Sorry about the curly one.
That's the first time I've been asked that one.
Well, you don't have to answer about
no,
Cheryl.
No, all I would say, from an AFL perspective, when you're so appreciative of the support that the media gives the AFL, and Doug Robertson in South Australia, the support of the advertising in the Sunday Mail for the SAFL is just terrific. If you really do enjoy the support, and I'm now back with my AFL hat on, then from time to time you're going to suffer the flip side of that. You can't sanitise what people are saying about you or your game. You give a bit, you take a bit. No one makes you do it. And on balance, I'd clearly rather have the great support and the downside that sometimes goes with it, a la Wayne Carey, a la the drug allegations earlier in the year, a la the occasional fellow having a beer and someone wants to have a crack at him. There are downsides, but the upside far exceeds that. I'd like to steer away from Cheryl, and I'm sure you understand that if I do.
Wayne, just to throw back to the development of the domestic leagues, how was the...
Speak up, my friend.
Just to throw back to the development of the domestic leagues, such as the SANFL, how would the AFL react to a plan to lift the draft age to 20, allow young footballers to play approximately 100 games in domestic competitions, strengthen their bodies, get their lives sorted out before they play elite AFL football?
The AFL would react as we have, because that has been put to us by clubs. It's been strongly promoted by guys like Jared Neesham, who used to coach the Dockers. David Parkin believes the draft age should be increased. So we would look at that, Michael Angelo, with real objectivity. The questions you'd have to ask yourself include, but are not all-encompassing, what do these really good 16 or 17 or 18-year-old boys do for the next couple of years? They keep running around playing for West Adelaide or PAC Old Scholars, or what do they do? Maybe they can start at 18, but you limit the number of games they can play each year. Some of the lads are playing 50 games a year, which is just ridiculous. But the clubs are starting to begin to understand that too. And when you've got a guy like Mark Williams, who's a teacher, takes an enormous interest in young people, they're not going to keep playing kids if there's some downside in a physical sense. So I think that there's nothing wrong with going up. You could go up to 20 and it might work, but probably a better arrangement would be to keep it where it is at about 18 years of age and be more sensitive to how you develop the lad. And I think clubs are increasingly doing that.
The only thing to that, Wayne, is it ignores what Malcolm Blight learnt from his life, that it was better for him to play 100 games in the SANFL before he went to North Melbourne, that it would help the SANFL maintain itself as a premier competition. It seems that the 18-year-old draft ages, let's quickly get him up to the AFL, like a Nick Stevens at 18, he's going to be no worse player at 20 when he joins Port Adelaide than he was at 18, is he?
No, that's true, but for every time you throw up Nick Stevens, I'll throw up Nick Riewoldt, who clearly at 18 and a half is well and truly ready for AFL footy, and he'd still be running around the Queensland Footy League. That wouldn't be right. But my grandson, there's no black and white answer to that. I'm not definite one way or the other. Everyone would have a view on that.
Well, as a person involved in junior football development in non-SANFL leagues particularly, I'd echo those things and certainly say...
Name, please. Name.
Sorry, Paul Roberts from WorkCover Corporation. In that regard, I'm glad to saddened by your injuries, but glad to see you back at work.
You still owe me $109.
Okay. I don't think... We don't actually cover you. Cheap shot. No, we don't actually cover you, but certainly glad to see. But hopefully you're an advocate now for safe work as well. I think that you know, echo your comments about youth development. What I see through the under 14, under 17 leagues is the obviously the incompatibility of development of different people. And there are people capable at 18 of playing AFL and some who are not. And we do need to recognise that in a centralised system. My concerns, seeing the sort of things I see on the field, are some major issues, I think, for football and for other sports. But clearly there's a real problem in football outside the major leagues in terms of umpires. Their capacities as umpires and also their availability. There is a shortage of umpires, and they're a crucial part of the game. In terms of junior development, AusKick is a fantastic initiative, but beyond AusKick, I see a lot of kids in junior football who cannot
kick
a ball.
Could you turn it into a question, please?
Yes, I am. I see a lot of kids who don't kick a football, etc. I think that's that period between the kids of AusKick primary school up into your 15, 16 youth development squads is an area where we need to emphasise a greater interest in coaching. Do you think the major clubs that you're obviously benefiting most from the AFL revenues are actually putting enough into developing the skills of the junior footballers outside their ages?
All of the clubs would like to more strongly promote in specific regions, and those recommendations are being considered by the Commission at the present time. So the short answer to that question is they're not putting as much as they could. They're putting in one hang of a lot more than anyone even begins to understand that they begins to understand they're doing a damn good job. But the clubs themselves would like to have a greater role in the in promotion and development at kids level. So that would be my answer to that question. The first part, you're absolutely true. Umpiring and the resources, the scarce resources, huge problem for sport. But we think we can help that at AFL level by adopting approach of zero tolerance to abuse and by more efficient... And that'll take a generation to flow through, but it took a generation to get on top of the racial vilification issue. It took years to get on top of the drug issue. It will take years to get on top of the tolerance to umpires and abuse. But we've started and we will, but it's going to take some time.
Say three quick ones.
Rebecca Devlin from The Advertiser. A quick question. Should teams be able to sell their home games to teams like Sydney and Brisbane, and does that give them an unfair advantage?
I think for the moment it's okay for them to sell a home game into a developing market. We only get to see the Swans in Sydney 11 times a year and the Lions in Brisbane 11 times a year. We get to see our AFL teams, and I know it's Port 12 times or Crows 12 times in Adelaide, but we do get to see 22 games of AFL football, and we do get to see 110 games of AFL footy in the city of Melbourne each year. I don't think it's, I think in a developing market, if they get another game to make 11, as in Melbourne going to the Lions last week, or Western Bulldogs playing in Sydney to make it 12, I think that's okay. I think it's absolutely wrong, and it would never happen that you can just buy your way into where you want to play your game. There's some balance in it. We would not let a club come to Adelaide to play against Port Adelaide or Crows at Football Park by buying their way in, because we in Adelaide see sufficient footy now, and there's heaps of capacity at Football Park to go and watch a game if anyone wants to go. So why do we want more football?
Just on that though, the poorer clubs in Melbourne say your Kangaroos, they're prepared to sell their games to get a bit more money because there's a financial bonus for them. However, you know, it does give Sydney a big advantage for them, surely.
Well, it's an advantage for any club to play at home, but it's not Sydney-driven. It's the club that wants to go there. But again, I just say we're quite happy if it goes to Sydney for the reasons I've outlined. I did say earlier, look, clubs don't need... if all clubs sold games, it doesn't solve any problems because the gap between the top and the bottom will still be there. If only the bottom teams sell games, you impact on membership, you impact on sponsorship, you have, you know, cascading effects through the system. So, answer your question, one or two games, yes, 10 or 12 games, no. Okay.
Can I have a last question, please?
Sorry, I'll just ask one quick one. We had a girl, 10-year-old girl, kick 16 goals a couple of weeks ago.
She'll be drafted.
Is a girl ever going to play AFL?
It would be a very brave person to say a female would never play AFL because I don't think 20 years ago the answer would be clearly no, I think. There's a lot of old footy guys here. But today when the game's extremely athletic, very fast, very skillful, 16 guys, a female can do all of that. Will she be prepared to accept the punishment that must come inevitably to her body to compete? You may be able to answer that better than I. So if you can get over that last issue, maybe, but they will have the pace and the skill and the endeavour to do all of that, but there's one really important ingredient left if you want to be an AFL footballer.
We'll make this the last one, Joey.
Hey, Christopher Pat, what stands in between us and a longer AFL season?
Do we want to see more AFL football? Do the broadcasters want more AFL football and will they pay for it? If we want to see more AFL footy, if we want to see Port and Crows play another game at Footy Park, are we happy to pay increased membership? It costs money to support sponsors. Will the sponsors put in more money? Will the players want more money to play an extra game? Lots of questions that we're working our way through. You will be interested to know that when we asked the footy fans whether they want a longer season, 6,000 replied last week either via the internet or via our website and in writing, and overwhelmingly, yes, they did want a longer home and away season. If so, how much longer? The answer was 8 games. So the most of those that wrote in and said they want a longer season wanted 8 more games. I'm not sure Greg or I would survive if that was the case.
I think I'll let Michelangelo have one last one.
Wayne, Liz wants to play golf in Adelaide again. The farm looks good. How much longer are you staying at Colonial Stadium?
There's been lots of conjecture on that, Michelangelo, so I'm very pleased to say on my home ground that I will not be retiring at the end of this football season. I will not be retiring this year, and whether it's next year or the year after that, you'll be one of the first to know. if they're all the questions, all we're allowed, it's obviously, I hope you can see that it's a real pleasure for me to talk and to be able to talk about footy and a few other things. Just a great place to be back here, albeit for a very short period of time. Thank you for your courtesy and thank you for listening to me. Thank you.
I take it that means you won't want this magnum of St. Hugo Cabernet Sauvignon from Orlando. You will?
Thank you, Don.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, the final bit of housekeeping before you race out the door. We do, of course, have the raffle to draw. Can I have Susan Karakousis? on a feet, and to draw, what about Grant heading Channel 10 News Director? Where are you, Grant? Grant's a member of our committee. We're really pleased to see him here today. We'll just bring him forward. The first prize is from Telstra, our cordless phone. We have a red ticket, D39. Yes, we're going to do Rex's painting. Now, we know that he hasn't been adding any dots over the lunch hour. We don't think so. That's red wine, the red dots. And we have an orange ticket, E56, the Oakley, the advertiser. It went back home, Rex. Now we have, in fact, two morning teas, I believe. Well, and perhaps Lisa would like to come forward and present this one. The Adelaide Symphony Orchestra. You can have morning tea for six, listening to the Adelaide Symphony Orchestra rehearse. And we have a black ticket, E45. It looks like Brett Thomas and Kelly Services. Is it Brett or is it Scott? I can't tell. The ticket's been torn in the middle name. We haven't. Right. We have the first one. The next one's incognito. For the second morning tea, we have a red ticket, D54. Same table as the first winner, I think. Now, yes, please keep going. We have some cartons of beer from SA Brewing. Thank you, SA Brewing. We have, you can have a choice. The first ticket out is blue A49. Paul Commode, Sunday Mail. Oh, good, good. Someone from the Sunday Mail. We love the Sunday Mail. Besides, I'm twice as much in trouble because I denied him a question right at the end. We ran out of time. He can take a choice of the cartons from the front. We have another one, red B85 for another carton of beer. Lucky last. Last carton of beer, and the ticket is orange E23. All well claimed. Ah, someone over at the SA Water table, Mark Jones. Well, he probably knows you need really good water to make great wine, great beer. Thank you, Mark. It's fantastic. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. That's all there is in the proceedings for the day. You're welcome to stay and enjoy the rest of your dessert and coffee. And we look forward to seeing you at the next Press Club lunch. There are invitations out for you to pick up as you leave. If you would like to be on the Press Club mailing list, please leave your business card or your contact details at the front desk as you leave. There is no problem with anybody being on the list. It's not just for media. Anyone can have their name on the Press Club mailing list. Please leave your name.